Hey, you guys. Welcome back once again to Flickers of Fear. Got a little bit of an obscure one for you today, but I'm actually really glad that I got to rewatch this one. So I feel like in the annals of serial killerdom, if you want to call it that, the name John Reginald Christie is probably not all that familiar to Americans, I would say, but he is absolutely notorious in the UK, like one of the best known serial killers over there, at least as that was my perception. So this guy was just kind of like, he seemed very mild-mannered. His friends called him Reg, and he actually killed at least 8 people, maybe more, in the 1940s, and he sort of stashed their bodies in and around his Notting Hill flat, which is, you know, in London, if you didn't know. Now, he got hanged for his crimes in 1953, and his case is notable not only because of the number of victims and like the kind of fucked up way that it happened, like in that he was stashing the bodies in the house and stuff, but there was also the suspicion that Christie might have been a necrophile, so there was that as well. But there was also like a big to-do because a very, very likely innocent man was actually sent to the gallows, was hanged in 1950 for 2 murders, which it's almost certain that John Christie committed. So in 1961, there was a British journalist named Ludovic Kennedy, and he kind of specialized in talking about miscarriages of justice, like writing about that. So he wrote a book called 10 Rillington Place, and in that book, he laid out like all the proof, all the arguments and stuff like that, that John Christie had actually manipulated this innocent man that I mentioned earlier, who was actually this working class Welsh guy named Timothy Evans, into basically taking the fall for the murders of his wife and baby daughter. Now, like I said, Evans got hanged for this, even though they're pretty sure nowadays he didn't do it. Now, he got posthumously pardoned in 1966, but Evans's wrongful conviction and execution was actually one of the really big things that led to the UK abolishing the death penalty, because this was just like such a massive deal. So in 1970, they made a film adaptation, essentially, of the book 10 Rillington Place. Although they changed, I think the book title is like spells out 10, T-E-N, but the movie title is just 10, the number, but that's pretty much the only difference. Now, when it was released in 1971, I think it was released in Britain in 1970, and then maybe it came out later because I've seen like 2 dates. It kind of got a little bit mixed reviews, not bad reviews, but some people thought, I don't know, I just kind of feel like, oh, they didn't go enough into, you know, the backstory, like John Christie's backstory or anything like that, but I'll kind of get into that in a little bit. But yeah, so the reviews were kind of mixed at first, but then as time has gone on, because, you know, this is a 50-year-old movie now, I feel like the critical reassessment has been overwhelmingly positive, and it absolutely should be because this movie is amazing. Now, I first saw this movie probably, it's got to be like at least 20 years or so ago now. At the time, like back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was going back and forth to the UK a lot because I used to be married to a British person. So we would go back and forth to Wales in particular. And I was also really fascinated by British movies as well as British serial killers. So I like read a lot of books about them. So John Christie was actually very familiar to me. So that's one of the reasons that I wanted to see this movie all that time ago, and I absolutely, absolutely loved it. Now, it's not... I know that's a weird thing to say, because it's not, like, a real pleasant film to watch, I'm not gonna lie. It has this, like, real eerie... this quiet eeriness to it, and it's really, like... the quality of it is just very, very enthralling. Like, it just kind of pulls you right in. It's very drab and claustrophobic, but there's something that you can't really, like, look away from. And it's just, I don't know, just the whole vibe of this movie is just really, really great. So the movie was actually directed by Richard Fleischer, who I'm sure that I have brought up at some point in the past. Now, his resume doesn't really suggest somebody that would be the right person for this type of material or, like, the way this movie came out. He was kind of always known more as a successful money-making director rather than, like, an artistic one or an auteur or whatever. He kind of made movies all over the fucking place, but most of his movies were actually really successful. He made some movies in the 60s. He made 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, for example, Dr. Doolittle from 1967, Tora, Tora, Tora. He made Soylent Green with Charlton Heston, Conan the Destroyer, Red Sonja, and Amityville 3D, which we just covered, like, I think on one of the matinee shows not too long ago. He directed that as well. So like I said, his resume's kind of all over the place. But I have to say, he works an absolute miracle with this movie, Ten Rillington Place. He just kind of wrings so much gripping drama out of basically just a handful of characters and essentially a single location. It doesn't really expand outward too much from the house where it all took place. Incidentally, some parts of this movie were shot in the actual house where the real murders occurred. The real house was actually, you know, the address being 10 Rillington Place, obviously. It was actually, like, torn down not too long after this film was made. Now, other bits of it, like the exteriors and stuff, they actually shot it on the same street, but, you know, it's, like, a couple houses down or something like that. I think most of the interiors, though, were shot on a soundstage. The movie, too, also uses actual testimony and dialogue, like from the official court records from the John Christie case, wherever that was possible. So at the beginning of the movie, it's 1944, and we see a woman who's arriving at 10 Rillington Place. So she gets ushered in by this kind of creepy looking dude, a very balding, soft-spoken, spectacle-wearing motherfucker, actually played by Richard Attenborough, and he's so great in this. He's just so, like, bristly menacing, I guess, is like the way that he'd put it, which is kind of like what the real John Christie was like. So basically what the situation here is that John Christie has told this woman that he has some kind of medical training and he can help her out with her chronic bronchitis. So he makes a big show of making this tonic that has to be inhaled like a vapor and using, but like he does a little switcheroo and using like actually the house's gas, like the stove that comes into the stove and everything like that, he actually gasses her either dead or unconscious. And then after that, it's implied that he rapes her, strangles her with a rope, like to finish her off, and buries her in the back garden. So all of that established, the movie then jumps ahead to 1949, and we sort of get into like the meat of the story. So John Christie and his wife, Ethel, are subletting out the top two floors of their three-story row house. Now, apparently, there's an older gentleman named Mr. Kitchener who lives on the second floor, although we never see him. He was in the hospital or something at the time. But the top floor is still to rent. There's like a little sign up in the window. So then enter the Evans family. Tim, who is like, you know, the dad and the husband, he's actually played by John Hurt, who got a BAFTA nomination for this movie. His wife, Beryl, who's played by Judy Geeson, and their baby daughter, Geraldine. Now, Tim is very poorly educated and illiterate. Like I said, he's a Welshman. I really do like John Hurt's Welsh accent in this. It just like kind of took me back. And one of his big things is that even though he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, he really gets off on telling tall tales about his fabulously wealthy relatives, like he's like his dad is an Italian count or something like that. Also, like how awesome he is with women, and it's like, yeah, I've got all these birds, did this and that and the other thing, and it's all bullshit, but it's like he's one of those kind of motherfuckers. Yeah. Now, when he goes to look at the flat, like, and John Christie is showing them the flat, which is, you know, okay, but it's kind of like scuzzy looking. And he's like, oh, well, this flat, it's okay, but, you know, the one we had to come from was, like, much better than this one, but, you know, we just had to move for whatever. Like, he comes up with some, like, lame kind of excuse. But John Christie pretty much, you know, say what you will about him, but he wasn't dumb, and he pretty much, like, clocked immediately, like, this guy's insecurities and his prejudices, and he says, oh, well, if you don't want it, that's okay, but there was this Irish family that was in here looking at it, and they want it really bad, and so Tim is just like, oh, no, we can't have them have it. We'll take it. And I mean, it's very clear that he's desperate for pretty much any place to stay on his meager salary, despite saying, oh, the money's not an issue. I have all the money. My family's rich and stuff like that, which, like I said, is complete bullshit. So the family moves in, and it's obvious right from the start that Christie has designs on the pretty young Beryl, the wife. He kind of takes to popping into her flat, like, uninvited, like, hey, brought you a cup of tea, I was just making some, you know what I mean? That's like, and he's saying stuff like, oh, if you ever need anybody to talk to, like, I know, you know, I know how stuff is, and blah, blah, blah. And so he's, like, lending her a shoulder to cry and stuff like that. Now, Beryl is intensely creeped out by this dude, as you would be, but basically he's her landlord, and he hasn't really done anything overtly alarming, so she just kind of grins and bears it. She doesn't want to piss him off or anything like that because she knows that they're kind of in financial, you know, dire straits and they don't really have any place else to go. However, her and Tim have a pretty volatile relationship. And it so happens that not too long after they move in, she finds out that she's pregnant again. And then she starts taking pills to try to induce an abortion because there's just no way that they can afford another baby already. Because, like I said, they still have one that's, you know, just like a toddler still. So after she tells Tim about this, he basically goes off on a horrible, like, drunken tear. He's, like, screaming, and he starts smacking her around and all this other kind of stuff. And basically it wakes the whole street up, right? That's because it's, like, the middle of the night because he just comes home from the pub. So John Christie, of course, is very put out by all this commotion. And he's basically, like, threatening to throw them out if they cause any more disturbances. But Christie also uses this rift in the Evans' marriage to kind of wangle his way closer to Beryl. He basically gets her to admit that her and Tim were fighting over the decision, you know, or her decision. She's trying to, like, end the pregnancy. And he senses an opportunity. He comes up with a story that he's like, oh, before the war, I started to train as a doctor, but then I got into an accident and I couldn't continue, like, on with school. But I've assisted in at least 100 abortions. I totally know how to do it. And in fact, I'd be quite happy to take care of your little problem for you completely free, as long as you keep your mouth shut about it so I don't get arrested. Now, Beryl is grateful for this, and she's like, yes, please, like, please take care of it as soon as possible. And Tim doesn't like it at first, but they're eventually able to talk him into it. You know, he's still kind of reluctant, but he's like, yeah, you're right, we can't really afford another one, blah, blah, blah. So John Christie, though, taking advantage of Tim's illiteracy and his kind of, like, simple-mindedness, like I said, he wasn't really the brightest, he pretty much snows him with all of this medical knowledge that he has. And because he's, of course, planning to kill Beryl, he makes sure, like, before he does the procedure, to kind of plant the seed, like, before it takes place. He's like, oh, you know, it's, I'm good at this, but 1 in 10 women, you know, die during this procedure that I'm gonna do. And he also throws in some very subtle, like, victim blaming in there, like, hey, you know, if you guys had come to me, like, about getting an abortion earlier, I could have performed it with absolutely no risk of death at all, but, you know, you waited too long, but I can still do it, but, you know, it might go wrong. It probably won't, but it's all fine. Now, poor confused Tim absolutely falls for it. Like I said, not the sharpest tool in the shed. So the day for John Christie's planned crime arrives. But at this point, and this is pretty much what really happened, like, you know, this stuck pretty close to, like, the actual shit that happened. So it's almost like this real grotesque, like, comedy of errors. There's a whole bunch of things that, like, conspire to prevent him from doing his thing. Like, he's trying to get his wife out of the house, blah, blah, blah. So he tells her, oh, you know, I'm not feeling too well today, my back and everything, which he did have, like, health problems and stuff. Can you, like, go down to my office and tell them that I'm not going to be in today? And she's like, motherfucker, why don't you just call them? And he's like, no, you can't just call them because there's all these papers or contracts or something like that. And they'll want these. So please, like, go down to my office. So he's trying to, like, just get rid of her. So finally she's like, Jesus Christ, fine. Okay, so wife is gone. You know, that's fine. And then just as he's gathering his little murder kit that he keeps, like, locked in this first aid cabinet thing, you know, he's got all that in the bag and he's got, like, the tea and everything like that. And he's just about going up the stairs to Beryl's apartment. A pair of contractors show up at the front door and are like, hey, remember how you been complaining to the council about that fucked up roof on your outhouse? We're here to fix it. And he's just like, fuck me. And then, you know what I mean? And so he's like, well, should I... you know, everything was perfect and I was really ready to do this, but maybe I shouldn't do it because now all these fucking motherfuckers are gonna be trooping through the house. But they said, no, it's like, it's all just the outbuildings. We're not gonna be in your hair. And basically, like, Beryl is coming down like, are we gonna do this today or what? Like, I really need to get this done. So he's just like, okay, well, I guess we're just gonna go on with it and I'll just have to be really careful. So, spoiler alert, like I said, you know, I kind of feel like not too bad about spoiling because this is actually based on a real case. So it's not like it's any surprise, like, what happened. But poor Beryl gets killed, gassed, raped, and strangled in her apartment, on the floor of her apartment, just like the woman back in 1944. Now, after the deed is done, there's another kind of thing where her friend, who's, I think her name is Alice or something like that, where her friend, like, comes by and is, like, banging on the door and, like, she can't get in. And Christie is in there going, around, oh shit, like I'm gonna get caught and all this other kind of stuff. But eventually, like, the friend goes away, so he just kind of gets on with it. So when Tim comes home from work, Christy tells him, I'm sorry, but the worst has happened. Beryl died during the operation. Now, Tim is just absolutely shocked, and he's just inconsolable. Like, he has no idea what he's going to do now. And Christy, like, kind of twists the knife in further by, again, like, blaming, hey, if you'd come to me earlier, like, this wouldn't have happened. And maybe it was those pills she'd been taking to, you know, try to induce the abortion before. Maybe that fucked things up. It wasn't me. You know what I mean? I told you that this could happen and all this other stuff. And then, through a series of seemingly logical arguments, Christy is actually able to convince Tim, who, like I said, is kind of dumb, that both of them should not call the police, absolutely, because we just need to dispose of Beryl's body down the manhole out front, like into the drain, because if we report her death to the police, then Christy says, then I'll get in trouble for performing the abortion because it's illegal, and Tim will get arrested for knowing and consenting to the procedure, which would make him an accessory. He also low-key threatens Tim that, hey, if you don't go along with my plan, I'm going to tell the police that you did it. And he's like, and I'll have all these witnesses backing me up because everybody along the street has heard you guys' arguments and like you slapping her around and stuff like that. So no one's going to think it's crazy that you actually killed her. So he like low-key threatens him with that as well. So suffice it to say that it all goes very, very badly for poor, stupid Tim, who skips town at Christy's suggestion, leaving his baby daughter behind, supposedly in the care of a childless couple that Christy knows. In reality, I hate to have to inform you, Christy strangles the baby pretty much immediately after Tim is gone. Now, Tim actually goes to, I think, Merthyr Tydfil in Wales, where some of his relatives are, and when he gets there, he is basically like, he feels bad, like after a little while, like he starts, you know, his conscience starts to bother him. So he goes to the police there and reports, but he makes up like all these other stories. Like at first he's trying not to get Christy in trouble. So he says, well, I killed my wife and I put her down the manhole. And then like the police go and look in the manhole, but she's not in there because unbeknownst to him, Christy has put the body someplace else that he didn't know about. Cause he told him, I'm going to put her down the manhole, but he didn't actually, he hid her someplace else. Now, when he actually confesses and all this other stuff, they inform him, it's like, oh, you killed your baby daughter as well. And he is horrified because obviously the baby was still alive when he left and Christy killed the baby. So now he's getting blamed for that as well. And he realizes that John Christy did all this stuff and is now like trying to pin it on him. Now, Tim actually does, like I said, through a series of things where, you know, he ends up signing a confession because he was just, like, devastated and he didn't know what he was going to do. And then, like, he tried to come up with this other story where he was trying to not get Christy into it. But then when he realized that his life was on the line, then he started telling about what Christy really did and shit like that. So they kind of think that he's maybe not that trustworthy because he keeps coming up with all these other stories. Because, like I said, again, not really all that bright. So he actually does go on trial and he attempts to tell the court what really happened, that John Christy did all this and tried to like pin it on him. But John Christy, who is actually testifying, gives very, very calm, rational testimony that eventually ends up like convincing the jurors that Tim is the one that killed his wife and daughter. Like I said, nobody knows about the other women so far that John Christy killed. So to them, it just looks like a domestic violence kind of thing. So Tim gets executed. He gets hanged in 1950. And Christy is free for another 3 years. I mean, he doesn't do all that great. Like, he ends up pretty much, like, homeless or what in the UK they would call a DOS house. So I guess, like, a workhouse or whatever. But he ends up there because he can't afford to pay for the house anymore. But yeah, so he's free another 3 years after Tim gets hanged for his murders. And during those 3 years, he actually kills 4 more women, including his wife, Ethel, after she starts to become suspicious of him and kind of like low-key threatens that she might like, I don't think she like says, hey, I'm going to the cops, but she's basically like, I'm pretty sure like I know what you did kind of thing. And she's gonna leave and then he kills her. So he actually didn't get found out until a new tenant moved into 10 Burlington Place and accidentally uncovered, like, this crawl space behind a kitchen wall that he had, like, sort of covered up with wallpaper and shit that had a whole bunch of corpses in there. So, like I said, he was walking around free for 3 fucking years. So while the subject matter, obviously, of 10 Burlington Place is very unpleasant, and this is, it's like a just a bone-chilling story, not only because of the serial killer, obviously, but because this poor dumb dope, like, got hanged for 2 murders he didn't commit. You know what I mean? It's horrifying. But despite that, I mean, all the performances in this are fantastic, particularly Richard Attenborough and John Hurt. And, you know, their performances really make this, like, just a mesmerizing, hypnotic kind of movie to watch. I mean, it's grim, it's horrific, it's maddening, it's tragic, but you really can't help getting drawn into the story, even if you're familiar with the details of the real case, which actually I was, you know, to some extent. I especially like the way that the movie treats the material. It's not, like, exploitative at all. It's not gory, it's not lurid, it's nothing like that. It's very, very subdued. Now, as I said, it doesn't really give a lot of insight into John Christie's pathology or the reasons why he did what he did, which I think was kind of like the main criticism that it got when it came out. But to me, that made the movie creepier, like more disturbing, because you're basically seeing John Christie the way his potential victims would have seen him, not knowing anything about his history or his proclivities or, you know, what was going to happen, like what was going on in his head. So the fact that you're just kind of seeing him from that perspective, to me, like, makes it a lot creepier. So if you're at all into British cinema and, you know, sort of serial killer movies that are more kind of understated examinations of the case rather than real lurid or gory, like, over-the-top kind of serial killer movies, then this is one of the best movies of that type that you're ever likely to see. And it's one that really doesn't seem to get a lot of attention, sadly. So, I mean, check it out. It's definitely, definitely worth it. I actually watched it on Amazon Prime. It's on the Free to Me section on Amazon Prime, but I'm sure you can find it elsewhere as well. And that will do it for this Flickers of Fear. I will see you guys on the next one. Bye.